You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Edith Perlman's new collection of short stories, Binocular Vision, has elicited almost universal praise from reviewers, but also some puzzlement. The praise is for her writing, which Roxana Robinson in her New York Times review called intelligent, perceptive, funny, and quite beautiful. The puzzlement concerns Miss Perlman herself, whom almost all the reviewers confess they'd never heard of before this collection, despite the fact that she's been writing for 30 years and winning a lot of awards. This collection, which includes 34 stories written throughout her career, is published by Lookout Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Edith Perlman to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
In the introduction she wrote for this collection, Anne Patchett confessed that even she hadn't heard of you until she was asked to edit the Best American Short Stories a few years ago, and she read your submission. Now she compares you to John Updike and Alice Munro. Do you get tired of reviewers saying that they've never heard of you?
No. I've gotten used to it.
And it doesn't surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't surprise me.
Well, but you have won 3 O. Henry Prizes. Your stories have appeared 3 times in the Best American Short Stories. 21 of the stories in this collection have been published in 3 earlier collections of your work, How to Fall, Love Among the Greats, and Vaquita. So should I assume that part of the reason is that unless your name is Alice Munro, short story writer doesn't generally attract a lot of attention, the kind of attention that a novelist will?
I think that's true, and there are many short story writers who labor in obscurity.
Have you ever attempted a novel?
I have never attempted a novel.
Really? Because the short story form just seems so perfect for you?
Yes, I love short stories. I love writing them. I love the experience of having something that can be completed in less than 5 years. I feel I've landed in the right form.
Well, I guess it's like a poet who decides that she never wants to write an epic poem.
Yes, I think it is just like that.
But I wonder if you've deliberately chosen to keep a low profile. Your earlier books were published by academic publishers, not the major commercial publishers, and this collection is from Lookout Books, which is the literary imprint of the creative writing department at the University of North Carolina. Was that a conscious decision on your part?
To go back to the earlier books for a moment, my agent and I tried to publish them in larger houses, and the larger houses weren't interested. So
even after the O. Henrys and all of that?
Yes.
Shame on them.
Shame on them, indeed. Lookout Books was a little different. That's a new imprint that's been started by 2 young and extremely vigorous people. They knew my work and they asked me to be their debut author, and I was pleased as punch.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you can read something for us and then we'll talk about some of the stories.
Certainly. I think I'll read from the story Purim Night, which is about or takes place on during the holiday of Purim, a Jewish holiday in which the Jewish people are saved by Queen Esther and her Uncle Mordecai. They are saved from the wicked Haman. But the holiday is mainly a costume party, and this particular party takes place in a displaced persons camp in Germany just after World War II. Roland, the head of the camp, was dressed, he claimed, as Dionysius. That is, 2 sprigs of juniper were pinned to his scant hair, one falling onto his forehead, the other nestling within his humble nape. Most costumes were equally rudimentary. Where could displaced persons get fabric, jewels, gauzy shawls? Yet some had indeed procured such items. A wife had made a royal garment for her husband. It was a short black silk cape, formerly the lining of their only coat. They wouldn't need a lined coat in Palestine, this loving spouse explained. She had adorned the cape with little white fur tails, which on close inspection turned out to be the inner stuff of sanitary napkins. Several young Mordecais wore, in front of their ears, scholarly coils, the strapping tape from Red Cross packages. One Esther had saved a beaded dress from her dead mother's wardrobe. Another wore a dirndl skirt and a jersey shirt that said Englewood High School. A Catholic family slipped in shyly, wearing Easter finery. After years in a cardboard valise, the clothing, too, seemed to be cardboard. Young Ludwig and his Uncle Claude had encased their upper bodies in splintery barrels that had held potatoes. Their heads were crowned by circlets of dry leaves. Black King was painted on Ludwig's barrel. Uncle Claude was the White Queen. King, Queen, Wise Man, and the occasional hero. Cigar stubs identified Churchill, a cigarette holder, Roosevelt. No one came dressed as Haman. Haman adorned the yellow walls, though. He was painted in green, painted in black tar, drawn in pencil, cut from brown paper. Many Hamans were rendered feet up, head down. Each wore a little black mustache.
Edith Perlman reading of the, it's called Purim Story? I'm
sorry. Purim Night.
Purim Night from her new collection called Binocular Vision, new and selected stories, now out from Lookout. And this, like many of the stories, takes place elsewhere. It doesn't take place in the United States. A lot of these stories are set in Europe or Latin America. You have also done some travel writing. I don't know whether that's what inspires you to think about a story set in Germany after the end of World War II.
I have done travel writing, and I have set stories in places that I have visited. But this story was not inspired by travel. It was actually inspired by the story that I wrote before this, in which the director of the camp, Roland, and his wife, Sonia, were working for the Joint Distribution Committee during the war.
Mm-hmm. So one story will lead to another story?
Yes.
Do you see them as, to some degree, in dialogue with a conversation with each other?
Or
because that's what painters do. You'll do a painting, and then that will then suggest the next painting and then the next one. And that's why we want to see a complete show rather than just one painting to understand what a painter is all about. I think the same thing would be true with a short story writer.
I think it is.
But in this case, the stories, as we said, some are new, some are old, and I have no idea which are which because they're not identified as such.
No, we didn't put dates on them. I think we just didn't think of it.
Really? So is this one of the ones that has been published before?
This is one of the ones that has been published before.
Now, many of the stories have unexpected twists at the end. Maybe that's one of the reasons that they are so popular with the O. Henry people. Is that something you plan from the beginning?
No. A story takes shape as I'm writing it, and the twist, if there is one, comes from the story as it's evolving.
I wonder about the title story, Binocular Vision, one of the previously published ones. Why did you choose that as a title for your book?
Actually, that has never been in a book before.
Oh, it has
been published before. I chose it as a title, I think, because it appealed to me. I thought it was evocative. I thought it had to do with how you see things, and all my stories have something to do with how you see things. This is a more specific title than the others.
Well, this is, in this case, seeing things voyeuristically, and there are a couple of stories
yes.
that involve that. You tell this one in first person through the voice of a 10-year-old girl who repeatedly borrows her father's binoculars to watch a couple who live in the next apartment. What does she see when she looks through the Simon family's windows? I mean,
well,
what is she looking for?
She is looking for some version of a family. She herself has a happy family, but she's looking for something perhaps a little more interesting. And what she sees, or what she thinks she sees, is a happy couple.
Mm-hmm. And her parents have no idea that she's doing this.
Her parents have no idea.
As the story progresses, the girl begins to watch her neighbors less frequently. Is that because she understands all there is to know about them? Or think she has come
She to actually it? Started in during vacation time, and she has to go to school most of the time as the story goes on. But I hadn't thought of why she does it less often. I think probably she did think she knew all there was to know about them.
And when Mr. Simon dies, suddenly there's an O. Henry moment. I won't give it away because I was as surprised as your narrator by what was revealed. There's another story, home schooling, where these kids also spy on their neighbors, and that's because they're not going to school, and their neighbors are, and they want to understand what a life for normal kids is like?
Yes, and this particular neighborhood is new to them, so they want to understand what goes on in this new neighborhood in a new city while they are not joining it in school but hanging around.
And then these twins, 11 years old, are surprised when they meet the children they've been watching later in a pizza parlor, and nobody asks them what grade they're in.
No, nobody cares.
How does a story like this, does this story grow out of binocular vision?
No. I'm not quite sure where it began, although most of my stories have two beginnings that intersect. Tim Parks said recently that so do his stories. Two ideas have to intersect before a story can be born. One of the ideas of this story was the illness of the father, and the other was, what is it like to be homeschooled? What is it like not to go to school?
And in the case of the stories that concern displaced Jewish characters, there are usually two things there, too?
Well, the romance between the director, Roland, and Sonia continues through all three. I think there are three stories in that series. And the other interest was, what was it like for people after the war who had nothing?
On your website, you listed matchmaking as one of your hobbies.
Now you will cause many people to call me up, I think.
Are there a lot of happy couples out there who were introduced to each other by you?
More than as usual, I think.
Is it a better way of dealing with that problem than going to one of the internet sites?
I don't know. I'm very happy about my successes, but so probably is the internet sites.
To some degree, isn't that also what writing a story is about? As you said, you take these disparate elements and you match them together, and that creates a story.
Yes, it is what the stories are about. However, you're the first one to notice that. It's a kind of matchmaking.
Uh-huh. I'm assuming that there are many others that you wish you could have stuck in this collection.
Yes, there are.
These are not. How did you wind up deciding to use these rather than some of the others?
In discussion with my wonderful editor, Ben George, we probably each had 10 more that we might have put in or talked about putting in, but we decided on these.
Well, I'm very pleased that people are starting to talk about you in the way that Roxana Robinson did in the New York Times. And I hope the next time you come by to talk about your next collection, we don't have to say, where have you been all these years? And we can just talk about the work.
Thank you very much. I hope so, too.
Edith Perlman's latest book, a collection of new and selected stories, is published by Lookout Press, and the title is Binocular Vision. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.